This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
You must remember a kiss is just a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh.
Eyes that smoldered with all the passion of the Orient, flickered with unslaked desire.
I entered the room as one enters in a dream, walking on air. Do you remember the graceful way people walked on those mirror-like floors? Thousands of mirrors on the walls.
One can never be sure of anything but a past like mine.
That was the voice of actress Merle Oberon, one of the great brunette beauties of Hollywood and British cinema of the 1930s and 40s. She appeared in classic films such as The Scarlet Pimpernel and Wuthering Heights, romantic comedies like That Uncertain Feeling and Affectionately Yours, and she was nominated for a Best Actress Oscar for The Dark Angel in 1935. This nomination made Merle Oberon the first non-white actress to be nominated for an Oscar, but virtually no one in 1935, or for many, many years, knew that Merle wasn't white. Welcome to another episode of Make Me Over, a special presentation of You Must Remember This. I'm your host, Karina Longworth. Today's storyteller is Hallie Bondi, a freelance writer and journalist whose work has appeared in The Outline, Eater New York, Paste Magazine, Vice, and more. Hallie, what made you want to tell us Merle's story?
I had come across an article about skin bleaching and how these products are still available today. They're very, very, very widely available in Asia, and they're easily exported here. And it made me wonder just how long these products had been used and if they'd ever been used in Hollywood and on whom. And it was like a lightning bolt when I discovered Merle Oberon, who I surprisingly knew very little about. She actually used these products in order to appear white. These skin bleaches were used for racial masking a lot in Hollywood. But that's only a tiny, tiny sliver of her story, as I discovered. She has a very unique look. She had to try to dodge the definition of being exotic all the time throughout her career. But today, she's just a stunningly beautiful actress. And I think that that was part of what Hollywood was wrestling with back then, is like, how do we make this woman marketable? Because she's just so stunning and breathtaking and talented.
Join us, won't you, as Hallie Bondi tells us the story of Merle Oberon.
Most of the tell-all books and documentaries on Merle Oberon's life came out after she passed away in 1979, and they rarely cite the secretive Merle herself as a source. This is problematic when there are many different and often conflicting versions of her story out in the world. The result is a tangled web of truth, lies, and publicity, which has yet to be fully untangled. Here's something we do know. Merle Oberon was born in Bombay, India, in 1911. She was half white and half Sri Lankan and Maori. It's important to note the historical context of Merle's childhood. India was colonized by the British. Eurasian was one way Merle was characterized back then. She was also called Anglo-Indian. Mixed people like her were typically the illegitimate children of British colonizers. In this deeply racist society, Anglo-Indians were not considered truly Indian, and they were far lower in status than the British occupiers. Anglo-Indian women were considered exotic and, among the British elite, reputed to be promiscuous. The rumors were true to some extent. Some Anglo-Indian women did seek out relationships with white male colonizers. But while these women might have been able to get something material out of these relationships, like trips or money, they would never have any real power in British society, nor would they have any status in highly traditional Indian society. Anglo-Indian women like Merle and her mother were in limbo and very vulnerable. In this society, any birth of a mixed-race child was considered to be scandalous and shameful. When it comes to Merle's birth, however, there was a much bigger secret than her mixed parentage. Merle, then called Estelle, was raised by Charlotte Selby. Charlotte was 26 when Merle was born. And she had another daughter, Constance, who was 12 according to some sources and 15 according to others. According to Merle's birth certificate, however, her mother was not 26-year-old Charlotte, but teenage Constance. Charlotte had become pregnant with Constance by a British officer when she was just 14, and she resented her daughter, who the teenage mom believed was an anchor holding her down in India. But when Constance was impregnated through a rape, as Charlotte herself had been, Charlotte's motherly instincts kicked in. She gave Merle all the love that she had denied Constance. Constance died many years later, estranged from her family. Charlotte and Merle had long since moved on. They became nomads, with Charlotte chasing fortune, largely through men, and little Merle along for the ride. Merle grew up to become startlingly beautiful. She was petite, with lustrous hair, full, pert lips, and a high forehead. Her skin was lighter than many Eurasians, and she had cheekbones for days. One of her teenage friends, Dolly Culla, shared her memories of Merle, who she called Queenie, in the 2002 documentary, The Trouble with Merle.
She was just a good-looking girl. There were so many good-looking girls in Calcutta at that time. A lot of the Anglo-Indian girls were very pretty. And they used to say that Queenie could be quite nice-looking if it wasn't for her chinky eyes. I mean, and that was probably one of her best features eventually.
In her late teens, by day Merle worked at a telephone company and as a typist. By night, she went out to Calcutta's vibrant nightclubs. She danced, socialized, dressed up glamorously, and feigned a posh British accent. She loved romance. Around this time, according to biographer Charles Higham, Merle began wearing white makeup. Such products were readily available to Anglo-Indian women in the early 20th century, from foundation to so-called skin bleaches. British companies were manufacturing them and selling them in India, where there was a huge demand to make Anglo-Indian skin as white as possible. Merle had grown up believing that dark skin was a curse, that it would doom her and the much darker-skinned Charlotte to poverty and obscurity. Compounding her racist upbringing is the fact that Merle was born the product of rape two generations over. While it's impossible to psychoanalyze Merle today, untreated inherited trauma is very real, and it can give someone the uncanny ability to be so disassociated from their true identity that the traumatized think they can slip undetected between false identities in order to seem to be whatever people want them to be.
I'm Bobby Finger.
And I'm Lindsay Weber.
And I want to tell you about a podcast I think you're going to love.
Who Weekly is a podcast about everything you need to know about the celebrities you don't.
Does celebrity news stress you out?
Are there too many people you've literally never heard of?
Check out Who Weekly, a podcast hosted by Lindsay Weber and me, Bobby Finger.
Each episode goes deep into the biggest celebrity stories of the moment. And if you're still confused, we even have a weekly call-in episode where we'll answer the most burning listener queries.
Who Weekly airs twice weekly with brand new episodes on Tuesdays and Fridays. Listen and follow Who Weekly on the Odyssey app or wherever else you get your podcasts.
In 1929, Merle and Charlotte finally got out of India and traveled briefly to France, then moved on to London, where she worked as an extra on a few films. She also worked as a nightclub hostess. Though clubs had strict rules that hostesses should not be romantically involved with customers, rumors swirled then and have been speculated on ever since that during this time, Merle was a sex worker. A. Scott Berg said this in his biography of Samuel Goldwyn, alleging that a night with Merle cost a couple hundred dollars, which amounts to about $3,000 today. This scrappy life continued until Merle's stunning, unique look earned her the attention of the right man's ex-wife in 1932. Maria Korda and director Alexander Korda had a complicated relationship. They were both Hungarians living in the UK. Alexander had made dozens of films, many of them European silence, starring his stunning wife Maria. The Kordas had hit a speed bump with the end of the silent era. Maria's thick accent made her unsuitable for Hollywood talkies, and her husband had bounced from the UK to Hollywood to France and back again, trying to stay afloat. In 1930, Alexander filed for divorce from Maria. She resisted. The two continued hanging out for a couple of years, and Maria hoped that she could convince him to remarry. That dream was dashed when she made the fatal mistake of helping Alex find an actress to play one of Henry VIII's wives. According to Korda's nephew, Michael, Maria spotted Merle on a British film set, dug her nails into Alex's arm, pointed and yelled, "There she is, you fool! Look at that face! It's worth £1 million! There is your damned Anne Boleyn!" Korda fell naturally into the role of father figure slash mentor with his female stars. And with Maria's career all but over, he needed a new muse. When he saw the young, exotic, and opportunistic Merle, he found one. She would take up all of his time and attention for many years to come. The first step was to change her name, Estelle Merle O'Brien Thompson, to something a little higher class and untraceable. Merle worked as a first name. She wanted to be Merle O'Brien, but Korda thought the last name was too lower class. They settled on Oberon, which had a distinguished, mysterious European flair. The newly dubbed Merle was now ready for her first star turn in The Private Life of Henry VIII, Korda's tongue-in-cheek romp in which Henry VIII burns through all of his wives in an hour and a half. Merle's Anne Boleyn is cynical and sad and resigned to her fate at the guillotine. Close-ups linger on Merle as tears well up in her eyes, and it's immediately evident that the camera loves her face. She was so, so young, only 22 years old at the time, yet she's composed and believably regal. You want more of her, but she's dead within the first 17 minutes of the film. Korda was keen on introducing Merle to Joseph Schenck, the former president of United Artists and the co-founder of the studio that would become known as 20th Century Fox. Schenck met Merle at a dinner party hosted by Douglas Fairbanks Sr. Schenck was floored by Merle. He took her out on dates, draped her in jewels and furs, and brought her on a dizzying tour of Europe. Out of the blue, in Monte Carlo, he put a diamond ring on her finger and announced their engagement to the press. But the marriage never materialized. Some in Hollywood believe that it may have just been one big stunt to boost Merle's profile. And if so, it worked. Merle used Schenck's interest in her to nail her first Hollywood role opposite Maurice Chevalier in a 20th century production called Folies Bergères de Paris. Merle's next film success came the following year in Korda's The Scarlet Pimpernel, a period comedy about an English hero who slyly saves the lives of aristocrats during the bloody French Revolution. Merle plays Lady Blakeney, opposite star Leslie Howard. Merle and Howard have genuine chemistry on screen, perhaps because they reportedly had an affair during the filming. In The Scarlet Pimpernel, Merle doesn't look white. And every now and again, if you're listening, a South Asian accent slips through.
Well, my dear,
about Armand. He's in the most terrible danger. They've arrested him at Boulogne.
In today's casting parlance, Merle would be labeled racially ambiguous. On black and white film, her skin color appears to be white, But her features were noticeably unusual in a medium in which actresses were overwhelmingly Anglo-Saxon. Film critics of the time recognized Merle's difference and wrote about it. As one Australian journalist wrote, quote, "Merle Oberon makes Lady Blakeney a personage of exceptional loveliness and of delicate sensibilities. The only disturbing feature is her tendency to strongly orientalize her appearance by means of facial makeup and the slant of black brows," end quote. In 1935, the Los Angeles Times printed that Merle was Eurasian. Merle refuted the charge in the same article, saying that the shape of her eyes and the fact that she lived in India were merely, quote, "odd coincidences." Merle told everyone that she was from Tasmania, Australia, which was conveniently very far away. In her story, she then visited Calcutta before going to London with her totally European parents. If anyone asked for proof, she'd tell them all of her records were destroyed in a fire. She notoriously told visitors that her mother was her maid. Yet, the hand-wringing over her race continued in the media. Merle needed a bulletproof story in order to change the narrative. And she needed a movie that would make everyone believe she was white once and for all. Her white knight came in the form of one of Hollywood's most powerful independent producers, Samuel Goldwyn. In 1935, Goldwyn was desperate for a new starlet. While other studios were teeming with fresh and marketable faces, Goldwyn only had women under contract with potential star power. He needed a Bette Davis or a Claudette Colbert. As the star power available to Goldwyn lagged, so did his revenue. Goldwyn was impressed by Merle's beauty and presence from her previous films and thought she would be perfect for a remake of The Dark Angel, which had been a star maker for Vilma Bankey when Goldwyn first made it as a silent film in 1925. By this point, a few major Hollywood producers were dying to work with Merle, which meant they had to pitch to Korda, who had eagerly taken on the role of Merle's gatekeeper, in addition to occasional director and producer. When Merle expressed interest in the role in The Dark Angel, Korda and Goldwyn went through months of negotiations, eventually landing on a 5-year contract that called for 3 pictures a year between them. The whole point was to make Merle a star, which would of course benefit Merle, but could also mean a financial windfall for Korda and Goldwyn. When The Dark Angel came out, everything went according to plan. No longer the cunning Lady Blakeney, Merle's character Kitty Vale in The Dark Angel is naive, chaste, and 100% devoted to her boyfriend Alan, played by Frederick March, who came back from World War I blind and reclusive.
This means
We won't see each other again.
Yes. But before that happens, I want to tell you that I loved you then. I love you now. As much. I love you with all my heart. I've never loved anyone else. I never will again. Goodbye.
Several reviewers of The Dark Angel breathed a sigh of relief that Merle could play a normal girl. What they meant was that Merle finally felt and looked white. At the very least, the world could suspend its disbelief. Merle was nominated for an Oscar for Best Actress for her role in The Dark Angel, but she lost to Bette Davis. Though she played much better roles later in her career, it would be her only shot at the award. That Merle had undergone some kind of successful rebranding centered on her deracinated appearance was evident in an ad she appeared in for Max Factor Cosmetics, in which the copy categorized Merle's before as, quote, "the slightly unreal exotic." Now, with the help of Max Factor, she was a, quote, "beautiful, natural, charming girl." The magazine ad contrasts two photos, both of which seem to be afters. But Merle's appearance had changed since her earliest films, Her hair had been curled, lightened, and brushed from her forehead. Her brow line had been moved up and arched, as opposed to slanted downward as it had been in the Scarlet Pimpernel. But Merle had also been using something somewhat stronger than Max Factor makeup. She had moved on from makeup designed to make her skin temporarily appear to be lighter to skin bleaching products that would actually change her skin tone. Contrary to the name, these products don't actually bleach. Instead, they disrupt the skin's production of melanin. This is hard to do without harsh chemicals and without applying the cream repeatedly. Merle was using a Unilever skin bleaching product called Light and Lovely, which contained the active ingredient ammoniated mercury. This can lead to mercury poisoning, which can have side effects ranging from skin rashes all the way up to weakened cognitive function. Merle had started developing skin rashes around her mouth from using the products as early as 1934. Ammoniated mercury was nearly completely banned in cosmetic products by the FDA in 1938. But these products were easily imported. They still are today. Today, you can get a $5 jar of Gori Beauty Cream from Asia, which contains 23,000 parts per million of mercury. The FDA caps safe mercury levels at 1 part per million. Skin bleaching is still a multi-billion dollar industry in Asia today. In 1939, Goldwyn decided to cast Merle as the lead Kathy in director William Wyler's adaptation of the classic novel, Wuthering Heights. Wuthering Heights was one of the most acclaimed films of 1939, and Goldwyn thought it was the best movie he'd ever produced. Vivien Leigh had been up for the role of Kathy, but Goldwyn had said no because nobody had ever heard of her in the States. That year, Vivien would go on to play Scarlett O'Hara in Gone with the Wind and win an Oscar. Though Wuthering Heights earned 8 Oscar nominations, Merle didn't get one. Merle delivered a command performance in one of the biggest, most respected films of the year, which sparked suspicion about why the Academy snubbed her yet again and throughout her career. When it comes to Merle's background, it was one thing to dupe the eager, movie-going public, who took their lead from gossip rags who were pretty much in the pocket of Goldwyn's publicity team. But members of the Academy were a different matter. While Merle told very few people about her real history, people in Hollywood did gossip about her quote-unquote Oriental appearance. And according to her future nephew Michael Korda, her accent would slip anytime she got tired or stressed. It was safe to assume that the Hollywood elite believed one Oscar nomination was enough for an Asian woman who possibly used to be a prostitute. As of 2019, Merle Oberon remains the only Asian woman ever to be nominated for a Best Actress Academy Award. And she didn't win. In the weeks after production on Wuthering Heights, Merle and Korda made a move to cement their partnership. They got married. Their relationship seems to have turned intimate in 1938, after Merle got into a car accident which led Korda to cancel the making of a much-troubled adaptation of I, Claudius, starring Merle and directed by Joseph von Sternberg. Though there were other problems with the film, mostly involving the temperamental Sternberg, Merle had suffered injuries in the crash that would prevent her from filming. And by this point, Korda apparently loved her enough that he couldn't bear to replace her with another actress. By Christmas of 1938, the Korda-Oberon coupling was the hot gossip story of the season. The wedding took place 6 months later in Antibes. Why did these work colleagues suddenly, after 6 years in one another's lives, finally get together? To some extent, Alex Korda had always been smitten with Merle. Although, since the end of his relationship with Maria, romance had not been his main priority. His designs on Merle changed around the time of Wuthering Heights. The film showcased Merle at the height of her powers as an actress and a celebrity. and Alex, the star maker's pride in the ascent of his Galatea, seems to have swelled into love. For her part, Merle was on the rebound from a failed affair with her co-star David Niven, whom she'd fallen deeply in love with. She had always described her feelings for Korda as hero worship, and now she was emotionally vulnerable enough that she may have craved an enlargement of his paternalistic role in her life. Plus, a marriage to Korda would solidify her place in British society, a childhood dream of hers. As Korda was a big star there, having basically ushered British cinema into the big leagues. Though some say Merle was not sexually attracted to Korda, and the sheer number of affairs she would have during their marriage would seem to back that up, she was full of professional admiration for him. Though some Korda family members apparently saw her as a gold digger, this characterization seems unfair. Perhaps if Merle had pushed for marriage in 1932 when they first met, it would make more sense. But Wuthering Heights seemed to signal that Merle's earning power in Hollywood was on the rise. Oberon would have desperately needed Korda's money in 1932, but she didn't need it in 1939. It's also worth noting that the Korda family were among the few people at this time who knew the truth of Merle's ethnicity. And if they were gossiping among themselves that Alex's new wife had married him for his money, in a way, they were telling on their own prejudices. Alex Korda hated Hollywood, and at the beginning of their marriage, Merle agreed to live in England with him and make movies there. But in the early 40s, Korda took a classified job with British intelligence to help the World War II effort. And the films he had promised to build around Merle were slow to get off the ground. Their last collaboration would be on the 1941 melodrama Lydia, in which Merle would play a woman with multiple suitors who can't have the one man she really loves. The film is told in a series of flashbacks from the present day, when an elderly Lydia sits with three men she had rejected and explains why she never married. At the end of the film, Lydia realizes her one true love has forgotten her and probably never cared about her to begin with. She also realizes that all of her relationships were illusory.
You opened your heart to the man who loved you.
No, none of you loved me, really. Bob loved a little idiot. Frank loved a girl with blue eyes and golden hair. You, my dear, you loved an angel. Richard loved only Richard.
I kept thinking as I was listening to all the stories, what was the real Lydia? Which one?
The real Lydia. Dear me. There was no real Lydia, Michael. There were dozens of them. Ask every woman. They know. Every woman is wise and foolish, clever and absurd, good and bad. Just as Lydia was.
Lydia is not Merle's greatest film, but this speech about fragmented identity seems like a fitting end to her working relationship with the man who tried the hardest to contain all of the different fragments of Merle into one marketable whole. By this time, Merle had become frustrated, feeling that her life in the UK with Alex was slowing her momentum as a star, and she started going back and forth between England and the States. In 1942, Alex was knighted. Merle was by his side for the ceremony, but she flew back to Hollywood the next day. Regardless of why Merle initially consented to marry Korda, she seems to have been openly unfaithful to him. In 1942, she reportedly had a one-night stand with James Cagney, the one time he was ever unfaithful to his wife. Well, according to Cagney. Merle had a very heated affair with 22-year-old former athlete and war veteran Richard Hillary, which he wrote about in his book, The Last Enemy. Merle's philandering was so flagrant that one night, Alex Korda was using the urinal at the Hollywood Brown Derby when he overheard one man in the restroom say to another, "Oh, you know who's screwing Merle now." In 1943, Merle met the cinematographer Lucien Ballard while making a horror film about Jack the Ripper called The Lodger. In order to help Merle hide her many scars on set, Ballard invented a new lighting called the Obi, short for Oberon. It's now called a catch light, in that it catches the gleam in a star's eyes, while the rest of their face takes a back seat. In a close-up of Merle in The Lodger, her emotive eyes are crystal clear, right down to the outline of her irises. You can't help but focus on them. The rest of her face looks smokier, as if in lower resolution. If there are scars there, you can't see them at all. Merle, bored with Alexander, began an electric affair with Lucien, who was part Cherokee Indian. In 1944, she divorced Korda and married the cinematographer. Even knowing of her infidelities, Korda didn't want his marriage to end. Before the divorce was final, he hoped to win Merle back by developing a new star vehicle for her called Dark Waters. Korda met with the eventual director of that film, André de Toth, to discuss the script. They agreed that it was, in de Toth's words, a piece of shit. And de Toth remembered that Korda was desperate to improve it for Merle. With tears in his eyes, Korda pleaded with de Toth, "I love her. Please help me help her." Merle did make Dark Waters with de Toth, but it didn't bring her back together with Korda. De Toth observed that after divorcing Korda, "You had a feeling that somebody had just let a bird fly out of a cage. Merle suddenly became much more free and easy." All her life, Merle had been afraid to have children, assuming it would give away her true racial identity. Now that she was with Lucien, who was also mixed race, she finally found the courage to procreate. But she found out from an OBGYN that both of her fallopian tubes had been removed without her knowledge during an operation a decade before to remove a cancerous growth. After this disappointment, Merle's marriage to Lucien was doomed, and they divorced after 4 years. Since Wuthering Heights, Merle had worked constantly. She starred in 15 films throughout the 40s for multiple studios, including RKO, Warner, and Universal. She was a multimillionaireess with a stunning jewelry collection that she loved to talk about. However, she never had another breakout hit. One could argue that Wuthering Heights in 1939 was her last true classic. And after its release, the extreme measures she was resorting to in order to mask her ethnic identity began to backfire. Merle was up for the lead in an upcoming Warner Brothers film called The Constant Nymph. She was slated for a screen test, but then came down with the flu. Merle took a sulfa injection. Sulfa had been the first experimental antibiotic before penicillin came along, and it was extremely popular in a wide range of products in the late 30s. Sulfa is in some medicines today that treat burns, arthritis, and Crohn's disease, but it has the tendency to spark a strong allergic reaction. Immediately, the combo of the sulfa and the mercury in Merle's skin lightening cosmetics made her face swell up. She developed rashes all over her face and sores in her throat. Merle was inconsolable. She had to undergo 3 agonizingly painful dermabrasion treatments in New York. She flew back to Hollywood wearing a black veil. Yet, Merle wanted the part in The Constant Nymph so badly that she insisted on a screen test. A note from producer Hal Wallace to the studio legal chief described the disappointing results. "Her face has not yet healed up, and close-ups and tests reveal a very bad skin condition, which makes it practically impossible to photograph her." Merle's desired role in The Constant Nymph went to actress Joan Fontaine. Merle was in another limbo, actually making herself sick, trying to fit in as a white Hollywood star, and paradoxically losing work because of it. Just as she would never fit into any class in India, in Hollywood, Merle had wealth, privileges, work, fame, but she would never be fully embraced as one of the elite. Her filmography slowed down considerably in the 1950s, With just 7 movies and a huge lull at the end of the decade, she was still mostly playing leading ladies into her 40s, but her peak had passed, and she had no Oscar to show for it. But Merle would not go out with a whimper. She still had decades of life in her, a few more movies, and a past that she couldn't bury forever. In 1957, Merle married Bruno Pagliai, a rich industrialist with multiple lavish homes in Mexico and one in Beverly Hills. They adopted 2 children. As the civil rights movement and the freewheeling 60s were slowly dismantling default institutional racist norms in Hollywood, Merle started to relax just a bit about her image. In fact, she was photographed flaunting her full-on brown skin in Mexico. While she did blame that Acapulco sun in an interview, she had finally stopped trying to hide the fact that she was dark-skinned. In a 1965 interview, Merle said she liked to wear white clothes because I'm dark, I suppose. She had quit using the toxic bleaching products, but her birth and nationality remained a secret, even to her new husband, Bruno. Their marriage wasn't a great one. In a 1973 interview, Merle claimed Bruno wanted her to stay home and be a housewife, which might account for her dearth of movies later in life. And yet, in 1975, Merle did something left field and kind of badass. She decided to produce her own independent movie filmed in Mexico. Very few people have ever seen Interval, and it's very, very difficult to find a copy now. However, the script, which was written by screenwriter and biographer Gavin Lambert, who is probably best known for the meta Natalie Wood film Inside Daisy Clover, clearly pulls from Merle's own life. She plays Serena, a mysterious middle-aged woman who meets the much younger Chris, played by the handsome Robert Wolders. Chris is in love with Serena despite their age difference, but Serena keeps pushing him away and lying about her background over and over again. They fall in love and have sex, but Serena is too haunted by her past to truly open up to him. As it turns out, her damage is that she got into a car accident and ran over the love of her life. Interval ends tragically in Serena's suicide. The movie enjoyed a very brief release, and not until after Merle died. But Wolders, who is 25 years younger than Merle, fell desperately in love with her on set. She divorced Pagliai and married Wolders, and they would live out the rest of her life together. Robert was apparently so deeply in love with Merle that he wanted to be a part of her whole life. He dogged her to show him her supposed hometown, Tasmania, Australia. Merle didn't reveal her secret to her new husband, but in 1978, she suddenly accepted an invitation to speak at a town hall reception in Hobart, Tasmania, where she was to be an honored guest of the mayor. They had honored Errol Flynn the year before because he was from Tasmania. They figured it was time to honor the supposed daughter of Hobart, Merle Oberon. The people of Hobart, Tasmania, didn't think Merle was white anymore. That ship had sailed. But they did believe very fervently, and still do, that Merle was born in Hobart as the illegitimate daughter of a Chinese laundry worker named Lottie Chintock. Chintock's family believed this and publicly claimed Merle as their kin. But apart from a birth certificate recovered deep in the records of a Mumbai government office, one that says she was born in Bombay and that Constance was her mother, there is no public physical evidence of Merle's birth. I suppose that the birth certificate could have been faked at some point and then buried in the Mumbai records for some reason. But another big hole in the Tasmania story is, of course, Charlotte, Merle's supposed biological grandmother, who, by most accounts, lived with Merle for her entire life and was definitely not Chinese. Regardless, Tasmanian residents had seen all of Merle's movies and embraced her legacy wholeheartedly and loved her as their own. She'd always maintained that she didn't remember anything about Tasmania because she had been too young when her family left for Calcutta. She was covered on that front. But the secrets had taken a toll. She started to have heart murmurs and blinding headaches in the days leading up to her trip. Once there, she barricaded herself in her casino hotel and wouldn't talk to the press. In her only interview with a local reporter, she never explicitly said she was born in Tasmania, only that she'd always wanted to visit. And as she climbed the steps of the town hall in Hobart, Tasmania, gearing up to address the reception, she started to unravel. Merle confided in the driver who was escorting her, saying, "It's probably a bad time to bring up the fact that I wasn't actually born in Tasmania. I was actually born in India." She then said her mother had fallen gravely ill on a ship, so they stopped in Tasmania briefly. She repeated this story during the event reception, where she grew agitated. According to a few witnesses, Merle felt faint and needed to recover in another room. For the first time in decades, at the age of 67, Merle publicly confronted her traumatic past and confronted the fact that she had lied about it to everyone, including herself. Merle had no support structure for this. Charlotte had died years before. She'd rejected Constance. And now she was facing hundreds of people who loved her for a fantasy. Her stardom, her jewels, the conveyor belt of men in her life, none of them could make it real. But Merle wasn't ready to fully let go of her mythology, even as she suffered cardiac issues and underwent bypass surgery. Michael Korda, her nephew, turned out to be an extremely prolific writer. He tried to write about Merle's true Anglo-Indian background in his biography, Charmed Lives. But in the months approaching Merle's death, she threatened to sue Michael and cut him out of her will. He thought it was kind of funny. "As if I was even in it in the first place," he told the LA Times. He asserted that he respected Merle and that her true life was far more fascinating than her fake one. In the end, he only included small, flattering snippets of Merle in the book, with no mention of her true heritage. Once the stitches were removed from her heart surgery, Merle was devastated by the scars all over her body. At age 68, Merle suffered a stroke and died. Her funeral was a somber affair in Beverly Hills. Most people thought that was the last they'd ever hear about Merle. Then, in 1985, biographer Charles Higham, in his book Princess Merle, published the truth about Merle's place of birth and her parentage. Michael Korda continued to write about Merle. His 1987 book Queenie is a fictitious work of pulp centered on a character who is obviously based on Merle. Queenie was made into a TV miniseries in 1987, starring actress Mia Sara, who played Sloane in Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and who is Italian-American. Other Anglo performers in Queenie acted in brownface. In his 1999 biography, Another Life, he was finally able to talk about Merle's true upbringing and how her presence in his youth affected his life. Though Merle agonized over her full story coming to light while she was alive, when the truth emerged after her death, the consequences were positive. By 1985, nobody judged Merle for lying, and certainly not for being Anglo-Indian. If anything, her life and her ambition, against all odds, were lauded as impressive and extraordinary. Perhaps the biggest tragedy is that by the time the world was finally ready for the real Merle Oberon, Merle herself was long gone.
Thanks for listening to Make Me Over, a special presentation of You Must Remember This. This episode was written and performed
by Hallie Bondi. Make Me Over was created and directed by Karina Longworth. That's me. I also edited the scripts. Our research and production assistant is Lindsay D. Schoenholtz. Our social media assistant is Brendan Whalen. Make Me Over is produced by Tomika Weatherspoon, and the audio is edited by Jared O'Connell and Tomika Weatherspoon. Our audio engineers are Jared O'Connell, Andrea Christens, and Brendan Burns. The supervising producer is Josephine Martirana, and the executive producer is Chris Bannon. We'll be back next week with another tale about the intersection of 20th century Hollywood and the beauty industry. Join us then, won't you? Good night.